I asked people's favorite episode from last year, and you were a frequent answer.
I feel like it would be FA. I don't want to say it.
It would be what?
Mr. Armenia.
Oh. You don't. Yeah, he's a favorite guest, frequent guest too. Mr. FA. Yeah, I'm just gonna call him FA from now on.
I like those episodes a lot with you too.
You are listening to Filthy Armenian Adventures. Hey everyone, it's your host Alec Mohibian with a quick note before we begin. Filthy Armenian Adventures is an interdimensional travel program that takes you deep into the cultural mysteries of our strange and interesting times. In search of truth, in search of gold, in search of lost friends and unsung heroes, in search of John Galt's motor. The show is supported entirely by patrons at patreon.com/filthyarmenian. Patrons get access to twice as many adventures, including the most intimate and scandalous ones, plus regular 5 to 15 minute smoke break mini-episodes on movies, shows, and topics of the urgent moment. Patrons also get first dibs on our next live event. The first two were a smash. It's very easy to keep Filthy Armenian Adventures alive. You can still listen to the premium feed on Apple or Spotify or your favorite app, and you can do so with the pride that you're putting a little bit of money where your soul is. More patrons means more landmarks, more hotspots, more secret locations and forbidden territories around the world, and the world that is Los Angeles, our apocalyptic headquarters. It means we'll be able to track down more enchanting figures in the landscape and dare them to abandon their masks. Patreon.com/filthyarmenian. Gracias for listening and enjoy the show. Nothing makes any sense anymore. Nothing. Nobody knows what is going on anywhere. We are adrift. We're adrift. The entire human race is out to lunch, and the service is slow. Here's an example. Nobody who knew me in the year 2006, who knew me and who knew of tonight's guest, would have ever predicted it was even possible we'd be having this conversation one drunk 18-year-old party girl later. It did not seem likely. If you knew me and tonight's guest back when she got famous. And you do know tonight's guest, you do know Kara Cunningham, whether you know it or not. Round about 2006, I was causing mischief on campuses using this ancient mode of communication known as the printed word. Ink, paper, all that shit. And my guest, under the nom de MySpace, Chris Crocker, was becoming world famous on an entirely newfangled digital thingamajig called the internet. She had more MySpace followers, or friends as they were technically called, than Lil Kim, and almost as many as, say, Britney Spears. Her short little 1 minute, 2 minute videos facing the camera were going viral before we even really knew what viral was. Before even YouTube, and then on YouTube.
Bitch, please. Bitch, please! Bitch, please! Bitch, let me tell you something. Bitch, please. For your own good, bitch, please. And then, of course, bitch, please. Those are the many variations of bitch, please. They come in handy in many areas of life. I hope they help.
Bitch, please was a huge hit, spawning all kinds of homages and spin-offs. This and That was another fan favorite.
Hey, what up, everybody? This is Chris. We got another... I'm still kind of blowing smoke out my ears because the haters just refuse to give it up, you know? And so the people that be saying, you know, this and that, yo. Girl, I don't understand. Look at this, girl. To the bitches that want to fight me. To the bitches that want to fight me. Girl, look at this, bitch. You want to fight me. Girl, what is it, girl? What I got to hide, nigga? What I got to hide, huh? Because, bitch, you want to fight somebody, bitch? Let's go, girl. I've seen it right here. You ain't saying shit to me, girl. I've been seeing it at the mall. Ain't nobody walking up to me, girl. Show tea like that.
There was an infectious energy to these one homo show internet videos that people just couldn't look away from. Especially not Dan Savage, biggest homo of them all at the time, who sent a reporter from his Seattle-based homo journal, The Stranger, to track Chris Crocker down in his mythically named small southern hometown of Real Bitch Island. Quote the reporter, "Those MySpace friends, Chris prefers to call them fans, hang on his every MySpace bulletin. They beg for the attentions of the young man with the lilting southern drawl and the fake eyelashes, declaring their love, their amazement at his boldness, their gratitude. They mimic his online videos, the sex-filled confessions, the wild monologues, and the messages to his generation that have all become viral video hits. They send tons of email with subject lines such as OMG, 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 and You are fucking awesome. And this feature story, titled Escape from Real Bitch Island, was published before Chris Crocker's most popular video of all, the one that broke every single cultural barrier and was shown on the news and imitated on late night shows endlessly, and the one even your fuddy-duddy ass remembers, the one that urged all the haters of the world to leave Britney alone. And by your fuddy-duddy ass, I mean my fuddy-duddy ass. I was never on MySpace. I wasn't on Chatterbait. I wasn't paying attention to videos like the ones Chris Crocker made, unless they made their way to Jay Leno. And frankly, I was way ahead of everyone on the task of leaving Britney alone. I had never not left Britney Spears alone. I wanted Britney to leave me alone, but she wouldn't, because my sister loved her. And they played her shit everywhere. Oh, here she goes. She's doing it again. Whoops. As for the diva part of it, I had my divas, but they were old ladies like Etta James who were doing sexy duets with their nephews at the House of Blues. Kara's career took some twists and turns as she tried to parlay internet folk stardom into a more conventional media career before the conventional media really knew what to do with internet stars. Nobody quite knew back then how to monetize popularity online. There were stints in LA where Kara would make appearances at gay clubs in WeHo. There was a 2012 HBO documentary about her life called Me at the Zoo. There was a foray into porn, including a scene with one of my favorites, Cliff Jensen. And there was a gender transition from which Kara emerged as Kara Cunningham in 2021. And then there was a cancellation freakout when she said the R word on one of her Instagram, TikTok videos, where the pitchforks and torches and mob squeals drowned the worst of anything she had dealt with as a flamboyant boy in the small Tennessee town of Real Bitch Island. And next thing Kara knows, she's listening to Red Scare, reading Camille Paglia, going on the Perfume Nationalist, and subscribing to Filthy Armenian Adventures. Who could have seen any of that coming in 2006 or 2012 or 2018? Who could have predicted This collision of strangers on a train, who could have ever foreseen my crisscross with Chris Crocker? So I invited her on to discuss how she got from there to here, how she got from Real Bitch Island to Little Armenia, with a few stops along Cliff Jensen Junction. Nothing makes sense anymore. Or perhaps to look at it differently, everything makes total sense. Once your vision is emancipated from what Jack Mason calls the heterosexual gaze. The heterosexual gaze. Very important concept. Many subtleties, many applications. Jack often uses it to bemoan the bland, popular notions of male attractiveness, but it figures way deeper and beyond that. According to heterosexual gaze, the only Christians are people who put a cross in their bio. According to heterosexual gaze, the only problem with feminism is how bad it's been for women. He's weird. That's awkward. I can't listen to Vocal Fry, bro. These are all expressions of the heterosexual gaze. Thank God for Dave Chappelle is a hardcore heterosexual gaze. It's not just a gay-straight thing. Many homos are prone to heterosexual gaze, and the most brilliant heteros are largely free of it, though most of us, in some way or another, have a little bit bred into our bloodline, because ultimately it is this moral, spiritual, aesthetic blindfold that gives us a literalistic, bureaucratic view of culture and people that overrates the safe laundered time servers of our moment and prevents us from noticing and appreciating the hidden sleigh in people, the John Galt's motor. As I say, highly complex subject, long study and experience required, but I decided to turn off whatever remains of my heterosexual gaze and watch a bunch of Kara's videos from across the years. You can follow her on Instagram at Kara-like, C-A-R-E-U-H, Kara-like, care-uh. Anyway, I watched a whole bunch of her videos, including the old classics and the new ones, and I was trying to see if I could identify the hidden message, the John Galt's motor that brought us together in this apocalypse. And here's what I've found. We have this thing. We are given this thing, this sticky, gooey, unwieldy thing called life. And so many of us, so much of the time, are like, ugh. But it's there, and it has so much potential, and there's this kind of bottomless supply of possibility if you are willing to get your heart dirty and engage it. There's this unnatural but natural electric sort of infinite potential at every turn and angle of this whole life thing. And there are people out there whose mission it is to remind us of this. And I think the underlying spiritual message of Kara Cunningham's very funny videos, from Bitch Please to Brittany to a recent Instagram video where she tries to wrap her head around what kind of person orders the Arby's roast beef sandwich without the cheddar. I think the underlying factor which explains how we ended up meeting strangers on a train crisscross, through the internet and over the air, the message of Kara Cunningham, the underlying message, can be boiled down to two words. I'm alive! And I see things mighty clear today. I'm alive! Singing my song, I'm alive, y'all. Yeah. And like a kiss being blown, we are on the air with Kara Cunningham. Truman Capote is not the only colorful boy from a small southern town to become world famous. We also have one in our own millennium. And I'm very excited to speak with her for the first time, even though we've been listening to each other for quite a while. And I'm very curious to find out about how you got involved in a world that led you to find A Filthy Armenian. And I'm very curious to talk about what you're up to now and your history since Leave Britney Alone. How are you, Kara?
I'm honored to be here. I am a little hungover because I was a whore last night, as usual, but it's so nice to be here. And thank you for that lovely intro. I'm all shy.
No, I like it. It's great. I'm so glad you were a whore last night. Turn off my notifications because they're going to drive me crazy. Are you in your hometown right now?
Yeah. Bristol, Tennessee, born and raised.
Okay. And it's a small town you're from, because it was something you kept private in your early days of internet fame, right? Where you were exactly the town you were from.
Yeah. And that's why I had to go by a stage name in the beginning, because this was like pre-viral videos kind of. So when I went viral, I really quickly had to I remember my first interview I did with like the Associated Press. They came to my grandparents' house and I refused to do the interview unless they would hide my location and not give my real last name, because this was at a time where people were just sending like anonymous threats and like they were calling my grandparents' phone, and you know, because I was still a teenager then. So like I was like, I need a stage name. And so that's how Chris Crocker came about. And so yeah, I had to be super private in the beginning.
I mean, I've read a lot about what it was like when you started out and how at least the way the media presents it, it's like you started being, first of all, everyone should know, before Leave Britney Alone, parts one and two, but it was part two that took off really big, part two of the video. Before that, is that the first viral video or close to it? Because people don't realize how close we are. Like how long, it was a very short time ago that there was no such thing as a viral video. Because there's no YouTube until like 2006 or 7 or 8, whatever it was. You were on MySpace initially, right?
Yeah, what was crazy is, so 2006, there was a thing called MySpace TV. And I was uploading just very performance art, always in character videos. And the first one got around 8 million hits, and it was called This and That. And it was just me cussing out people that wanted to beat me up at my local mall. And I was talking in this like affectation and just like, because, you know, in my real life, I felt or feel physically weak or whatever, but I found this camera from Sears that my mamaw had got. And I was like, oh, I can just like be as strong on the internet the way I can't be in person physically. And so, yeah, I started uploading to MySpace TV, and there was actually, I guess what nowadays you would call a fan account, that was like saving my videos and uploading them. And they actually gave me the YouTube channel where they had been uploading my content from MySpace TV. And then I took over the channel. And then, yeah, when Britney did her VMA performance, I put Leave Britney Alone up. To answer your question, I guess there was like Kelly Shoes that went viral then too, because I don't want to take all the credit. There was like Chocolate Rain, Kelly's Shoes.
Right.
But as far as like being on talk shows and stuff, I guess where it was about a celebrity, it was the first time that a viral video would be referred to in like, it was on CNN and The View and Good Morning America. You know, I guess it was like the first of its.
I mean, the fact that I knew, because I was not on MySpace and I was not hip to the social media. Like I was literally never on MySpace. I don't think I ever had a MySpace.
Right.
I didn't get on social media until I went to college and Facebook started. And Facebook started where it was only for college people. You had to have a college email in the beginning. Right. And I was actually, so I guess I was like in the ground floor on Facebook pretty much. It was like 2003 or 4 or 5. I was still in UC Santa Barbara. I remember when I started, and it was exciting mainly to just be in touch with friends from high school that I thought I'd lose touch with. I was totally out of the loop on MySpace. And when it happened, I mean, I knew about it. I didn't just know about it. It was like on the Tonight Show. Like I was, because I would watch the Tonight Show. I would watch late night TV, and it was on there. And it was like, everyone was like doing skits about it. You were getting, I mean, you probably had, there were probably SNL skits about it. I must have seen SNL skits about it. It was like, it was ubiquitous. And like everyone was doing their imitation of it. So I don't know how it like measures up with the number of views or whatever with the other viral, like, you know, OG viral hits. But in terms of cultural impact, I think it's like the most long lasting. I don't remember those others. I mean, I don't know who remembers the other stuff. Everybody remembers Leave Britney Alone. Everybody.
Well, the joke was on me because I thought when I deleted my YouTube channel back in like 2015, I was like, oh, I just want to be done with all this. I'm like so over it, lingering on. And then, you know, other channels just reposted and uploaded. But I have no idea what the views were at. I think it was like close to 50 million then. But I took the channel down because I was just, I couldn't even log on YouTube without, even if I post like a life update, like years later, it would be like, kill yourself. And so, you know, I've never claimed to be the most mentally stable person. And so I was just like, I'm not gonna keep putting myself on here, you know? And plus, this was pre people getting paid for videos. So in a way you were just putting yourself out there to just, it's like being a glutton for punishment. There was no reward other than, like you just said, people making fun of you on TV or whatever. And I was living, I had gotten offers for like reality shows that never went through, and different things like that. So I was living on couches in LA, barely surviving and not making any money. So after a while, I just was like really depressed. And I moved back to Tennessee, which is like the best decision for me. And I just like started doing porn. And I was like, I'm not going to fucking make any money, you know, from YouTube. Yeah. So I just started doing porn.
I want to get to the porn, of course, because that's a fascinating, and you've had the, you know, you've collabed, as they say nowadays, with some of my favorite porn stars, as we discussed, and I want to get into that. But first, I'm interested in that, like the very beginning of your story, because it seems clear that you weren't just spontaneously reacting out of nowhere. You wanted to be an actor, right? Like you were performing in Leave Britney Alone, mm-hmm. in addition to expressing your true feelings.
Right. So this is an interesting, I don't even really go into this in like the documentary that HBO did about me, because I didn't really have like too much of a final say on the edits or anything. But the real truth is that I believed back then, like what really was the sweet spot for me is performing my actual feelings, whether that be in character or whether that be whatever, for entertainment value, but with truth to it, right? Because at that time, my mom had just came back from Iraq. She was severely addicted to meth, living on the street. I couldn't get my grandparents to like believe in her to even let her stay on the couch for that long to like get her straight. And so there was a parallel in my real life of like, okay, I'm fighting for this woman who had me at 14 years old. Like my mom was a really young mom. That's why my grandparents raised me. And so I was super, I mean, you know, hormonal. I was a teenager. My mom's addicted to meth. And so for whatever reason, it felt like a smart thing to do to just perform my feelings into a camera. But, it, you know, like, yeah, there was a performative element, but there was also truth to it.
But you wanted to be an actor, no? Was that not your, like, dream at the time? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And it opened doors, but the doors ultimately, like, because you did come to LA, you did get, all these management companies all up and interested. But it's weird because this was like before, as you say, it was before monetization on YouTube. And it was before this, I guess we're about the same age, or maybe you're a little younger. I'm
36.
Okay, yeah, you're a little younger. But, I'm similarly in that, like, in that zone where the internet was, there was this long period that's hard for people to really remember now unless they were really truly deeply affected by it, where the old way of doing things was going away. The old, like, the non-internet kind of version of media and Hollywood and show business and journalism and everything, basically everything was slowly hitting the wall, suddenly hitting the wall, realizing that it has no future. At the same time, everyone knows that the future is going to be on the internet somehow, but at the same time, nobody knows how it's going to be monetized. There was just no concept of how anyone would monetize anything on the internet. Napster had kind of come in and made music seem like completely worthless. It was chaotic. So if you had this incredible social media presence, which nowadays and for the last 10 years or so would be it wouldn't only be a no-brainer. Anyone would be like all over you to represent you to try to that this is the way to be famous now. At the time, people just didn't quite know what to do with it exactly. So there was a lot of bouncing around and it feels like you would have been if your thing happened 6 years later, you would have been instantly making a lot of money, but not in 2006 or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's really, I love how much you get that, because that's something I can never really get people to understand that, it's bizarre because on one hand, with what you just said, what's fascinating is there was still a lot of old media at that time. The TMZ, the paparazzi. I had a very traditional, I guess you could say. I mean, I was filmed in situations that these days when someone goes viral, they're not, right? Like I had old media still around me at that time, which was interesting. Like I could literally go on Robertson and get tons of paparazzi. I could go on the Jimmy Kimmel show. And the inverse of that now is that you're right. I could possibly be on a Netflix show or whatever, but it's very hard to wrestle with this idea that if you're ahead of your time, there's these weird pitfalls. I had so many managers that would reach out to me at the time and be the only thing we know to book you for is a club appearance in Iowa or whatever. That's how I was couch surfing or paying people to just survive. And it's not like I was that kind of performer. So I would just end up at these clubs, lip syncing Britney's Give Me More and doing a striptease. And, it's really sad looking back at it. Cause I'm just but I guess I just did the best with it I could. But yeah, you're right. They didn't know what to do with you then. And in all the meetings, I went to pitch meetings at MTV, E! Network. And this is all pre-Kardashians and stuff. I think the only thing at that time that was a big reality show was The Hills.
Yeah.
Because I'd be walking down Robertson and Heidi and I would cross paths. We'd be getting the same paparazzi. So they didn't know what to do with you if you were just viral for crying over a celebrity, because they thought that was my one note,
Yeah, that's true. It would be, it's sort of like you have to have, and it's hard also to make, it's if you're a rapper, I feel rappers can go make an appearance at a club, at a nightclub, just appear there. I've seen it. And they're clearly being bribed with serious money, because anyway, rap performances are basically just appearances anyway. They just appear and then they pretend to sing and you can't hear anything anyway. Yeah. So it's sort of the same. It doesn't make any difference. And I feel like they can make a lot of money just popping up at straight nightclubs. But for the gay, in the gay nightlife scene, I guess it's not as lucrative to just appear at a gay bar. I guess what you really want to be, especially at that time, is a bartender, because bartenders get the mad tips.
Right.
And I knew a bartender at The Abbey, 2010 to 12, when I was like, when I first dabbled in the decadent sexual practices of homosexuality. I met a bartender at the Abbey who was telling me the amounts of money he was making. It was, and cash too, mostly cash.
Yeah.
It was mind blowing. And it was like, you were a celebrity if you were a bartender, but Chris Crocker, like if you're not getting paid up front, you're just going up there and lip syncing and you're not grinding on people's dicks and getting tips. Like, how are you supposed to make a bunch of money?
Right. Well, it was crazy too. I guess I should have mentioned this earlier. I was signed a year prior to Leave Britney Alone to a production company that wanted me to do a sketch show. So the crazy part is I had this, well, I had all this groundwork of skits that I had done pre-Leave Britney Alone, right? But it then put me in this box where, because in all my interviews, I wasn't willing to say that it was a little performative because I truly do love Britney and I didn't want it to be misinterpreted. It muddied the situation, and I had this groundwork of like at least 80 skits that were getting millions of views. So it wasn't as though I didn't show that I could act or I could do improv or whatever. It was just that I was now pigeonholed into this one thing, for lack of a better term, I guess.
You had a really funny skit where you had a really funny one where you pretended to be like a religious Southern religious like TV show, and you had your grandmother on and she was like very uncomfortable to be there, and you were like asking your grandmother if she supports Chris Crocker, and she was like saying, well, yeah, yes, I do, and you were like ripping into her for that. That's what was the name of that?
Well, Earlini character Edna, and Earlini Edna.
Early, yeah. Right.
And I did that based on truth, because my grandparents were getting shit from, they were Pentecostal, you know, my grandma, she passed, but very devoutly Pentecostal, and was getting a lot of shit at the local church when I did that AP interview, because I was like openly gay or whatever. And so even that character was like a play on the truth of like the church they were going to, you know? So, yeah.
So tell me how you... Like, I'm guessing you didn't have the best time in LA, but I'm curious now, because this is my town, and this is where my show is kind of based in many ways, physically, spiritually. I'm curious what you felt about it when you were here couch surfing and appearing at Rage, which no longer exists, by the way, and various other WeHo, Santa Monica Boulevard, stalwart places.
Mm-hmm. Well, so my best friend, Adore Delano, still lives in LA, and her and I talk about this all the time. Like, there, I had good times in LA, and we were actually just talking about Rage the other day, so I love that you just mentioned that, because that was, like, such a, important little space for when you're a twink coming up, because there weren't too many places that you could, like, go if you were, like, 19 then. So, I had good times, but I would say that they were the times after I like moved away and I would just go back and visit, because when I was actually living there, I was super suicidal. Like, I'm not the most mentally stable person. Like, that's not a secret. So being constantly like, well, what do I do to survive, and living on couches and scared to death if you make a drunk mistake that someone's going to tell your secrets to TMZ. Like, that was a really hard time, and I'm not going to blame that on Los Angeles. It was just the time in life that I was in. You know, I'm actually jealous of my friends that have a better relationship with LA, because all my best friends still live there, like John and Adore. So they want me to always visit, and I'm always just like, I have this like weird, not to sound too lib about it, but like weird PTSD around LA, and I just wish I wish I didn't, but I do, you know.
I feel the same way about Washington, D.C., where I spent 9 months after college. It's the only time I haven't lived in L.A., and I got super depressed there. Not suicidal, but, you know, close. Like, it was, you know, I'm not too chemically vulnerable to that level of it, but it was bad. I really hated D.C., and I have a similar relationship to it where, I mean, I don't have any friends there. I have a few friends there maybe, but I don't mind visiting at all, but I do have PTSD from that place. And I know what it's like to be somewhere in a strange new city when you're for the first time away from home and things aren't going the way you expected. And, you know, you have professional aspirations and they're not working out somehow. And, it's not easy. I feel like for you to come back to LA triumphantly, it's going to require a level of real, like, I don't know. You're going to achieve a level of like success where you're in zero way going to be triggered by anything you see here. And I think that's when you'll be able to make a return and kind of be at peace with it. That's how I would, what I would hope anyway.
Yeah. Well, I like what, you know, you said about, you know, like with your, it's certain place, it's hard not to associate the pain you were in with that place, you know, but it's, I do think you're right. Like, that's why I have to just make new memories there and not be so scared of it, I guess. But I don't know. I think too, I moved back here. I bought my own house eventually. And so it's like, it's so not in the forefront of my mind because I'm like, now we live in this world with podcasts, other things. You don't really have to be in LA, you know? Oh, yeah. And that's something I've been telling my friend John, like, who does music and stuff. And he is now realizing that, like, you truly don't have to be there. I mean, for certain meetings and stuff, you can even just do Zoom, you know? But maybe I'm just making excuses to
No, you're right. I mean, the main thing is with anywhere now, like you can do anything anywhere. There's literally nothing you have to be anywhere to do. But the main reason I think to be in a particular place is simply the social atmosphere. If there is one, like if your friends are here, if they're all working in the same kind of world, then you'd have, you know, right. Just like the same with New York or same with wherever, like you have a sense that that something is happening around you and in what you do. And that would be the only reason. I mean, honestly, like there's no scene really just about anywhere, except for maybe a little pocket in New York. There's no scene in LA either. It's just people doing their thing. I have a very different relationship to LA than most people because I'm born and raised here. So I have it's this big puzzle called home that I've been trying to piece together my entire life. It's very different when you're coming here chasing success. And when it coincides with you know, the traumas of coming of age, the traumas of maybe your, you know, dreams not panning out exactly as you hoped, it's a really hard place to be lost in. It's important to kind of have a stable center and explore from there. But when you come here looking to find yourself right away, it's really hard, really hard.
Right. Well, and yeah, and again, not to keep revisiting it in like a negative way, but I think the false promise that I already had success waiting for me, right? Like some people just go there. I was on this like high of 15 minutes of fame. So I went in with this sort of like, oh, well, there were opportunities. Like, you know, I had Jimmy Kimmel calling a lot for me to keep going back and like little things like that. But I went there under this like false promise that like, oh, well, I already have all this buzz going. And again, I was just, all I ended up doing was flashing the paparazzi for a little bit more relevance and entertainment value. But, you know, I was also just a teenager. So maybe one day I will go back and build a better relationship with it. I do like Silver Lake though. So if I go back, you know, they have those cute little diners. So, you know, maybe I'll go to Silver Lake and get a chili dog.
Yeah, the Silver Lake has one of the only 24-hour diners that's still 24 hours too, called Astro Family Restaurant. Some of the Silver Lake places
is that the one that's like swingers? I'm sorry,
kind of. Yeah, it's very swingersy. Yeah, but okay. More run. Swingers is a little too try hard
Americana.
In the way it's
yeah,
it's a little too like of a movie set, you know, and their portions are too small. I'm not a fan of swingers, to be honest. Their portions are too small, their prices are too high. The actual diner that was in Swingers, the Cafe 101 at the Best Western on Franklin, that which used to be 24 hours, again, that died during the pandemic after God knows how many decades. It is now another diner that is closes at like 3 p.m. or 9 p.m. depending on the day, called Clark Street Diner or something. I've been chronicling the ups and downs of LA diner life extensively, and it causes me much grief. And you know how many tears are left to shed. I always start screaming when I find a new place that's like suddenly closes at 3 p.m. now, or half of the week is closed, or whatever. It's very annoying.
These are the things my best.
Leave the diner alone.
Literally, I'm so stunned because. No, I mean, this is what I'm so interested in that, because those were the only things that gave me any remote comfort when I was there, was the little diners. Like, I loved it so much. And so Adore and I will be texting because she lives there. And I'm like, are you still going to, you know, the local legendary spots like Cantor's? Are you still going to Swingers? Are you going to Barry's Pizza on 3rd? Because there's all these new places that are appealing to like the TikTok sort of world of people.
Yeah.
And it makes me so sad that like they're overtaking things.
It is. So. They don't have very good taste, the TikTokers. What do you think of TikTokers? Like, because TikTokers are the spawn of your genre. You're the founding father, and they're like the... You're like, they're like the...
I don't know if I want to take that.
No, but well, I mean,
I know what you're saying. I think, I don't know. If I'm being optimistic, I think there is some good to it. And here's what I'll say. The good to it is that it's not algorithmically, there's not a cap on the algorithm the way there is like Instagram or say Facebook. You really can open your app and see all these new people and discover all these new voices in a way that other apps really seem to hate, because they want to control who the faces of the websites are. Same thing with YouTube. I can remember specifically to the date when production companies started hiring people, and I'm not naming names, but that they would put on the front of it. Whereas before, it was you would have like number one video of the day and a whole like top 20 list, right? And that was just based on viewers organically, you know, gravitating to something. Now, everything seems to have this like controlled, I don't know, it's disheartening. But I do like that about TikTok, I will say. Like, you really can discover random people you'd never see. That's the upside for me. But I don't know that it's encouraging people to put out like necessarily good content, because you can't even, I don't think you're allowed to even curse on TikTok. So like, if you have a, you know, a dissenting opinion or something, I get a little scared of that on TikTok. So I save that for podcasts and things like that.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
that is interesting. You note that, cause I'm not on TikTok at all. I'm kind of just like afraid of it. I'm just afraid of it a little bit, but it's definitely something to note if it's true that I guess it is, that it still has a kind of a freewheeling algorithm versus YouTube, all of the other social medias are completely, completely siloed. They're so bad now. Mm-hmm. And I remember what it was like when they were open-ended. I mean, you just have to look at Google itself. You don't even have to look at social media. You just have to try the search engine Google. You can't find anything on Google that's not like official, you know, mainstream media type of thing. You can't find anything. And it's super sinister and super boring. It's made everything really, really lame. It's a bastardization of what the internet is supposed to be. I guess that's the appeal of TikTok. Yeah, I mean, I was kind of thinking more like about the content of TikTok and the ways in which it seems to be like, I look at these faces on TikTok and they all seem to have the same cartoonishness, you know, like it seems like everyone's just trying to be a cartoon character and beat the AI to the punch. But
I even give in to that. At times, like I think yesterday I filmed a video with a banana ponytail. Like I put a banana in my ponytail. Well, it's because the impulse is to grab eyeballs from the very second, right, that they even see the thumbnail and they're scrolling, because it's a scrolling contest now. It's so, as Red Scare always says, we live in an attention economy. So I even give into that impulse at times. Yesterday, I had no reason to put a banana in my ponytail, but I did it for the visual. You know, you want to stop people from scrolling if you're trying to make money, which, and that's, I will say that too. Their, what's it called? BPM rate per video is really good. Whereas Facebook's has gone down. So you can't really profit as much on Facebook.
So BPM is, BPM is something money, BP money.
It might be RBM. I don't know what the term is, but it's basically the amount of money you make per view, right?
And right, so return on, it's probably, yeah, return something. Okay, I see, yeah.
Yeah.
So per view, you're getting more bang for your buck, for your popularity on TikTok, right? That makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, it's,
but
you know,
I know what you're saying, though. It does encourage the... the lowest part of the human spirit, I guess, to, you know, just be cartoons. I'm happily a cartoon as long as I can let people know I'm also the drawer of said cartoon.
Right.
But that's fine with me. I'm like, I'll objectify myself and put bananas in my hair. It's fine. I just need the money in return. You know.
Yeah. Well, the interesting...
I'm capitalist in that way.
Yeah, you're a capitalist. We know. I mean, how else would you find us? That's what I'm fascinated by, because it's really interesting that you go from being like the poster child of a gay boy in a small town full of homophobes. There's a story about you being, I read a story about you in The Believer, which is that magazine by David Eggers.
Or is it The Stranger?
The Stranger.
Oh, okay.
The Stranger. Was it The Stranger or The Believer? Yeah, Stranger, where somebody went to visit you in your town, and like, mm-hmm. he was obviously
that
really...
That was before Liberty Alone.
That was before. Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. So it was called Return to Real Bitch Island, which is just a reference to a video. That's really the only time capsule that you can find that's like pre-Leave Britney Alone media, I guess you could say, because... Remember when I said earlier, like, I was signed to hopefully get, like, a sketch comedy thing. That was around that period, and he had just been watching my MySpace videos, Dan Savage, who ran The Stranger, yeah. and sent this journalist down. That was, like, my first ever interview with any sort of interviewer, like, whatever, you know, so.
It's a really interesting piece.
That brings
piece.
Back good memories.
Yeah, sorry. Because he also kind of... He kind of celebrates you all. The reporter, whose name I don't remember, but it's in my phone. I was just reading it. He also kind of celebrates you as a civil rights hero on the strength of your video, Bitch Please, where you did various different imitations of Bitch Please in black voice. And then, and then that was such a sensation that black kids started imitating you doing black voice, saying Bitch Please.
Well, I was calling... Well, what it is, and I always give credit, I will always give credit. I was calling this trans party line. This was back when party lines were all you had. We didn't have like group chats and shit like that. So I found this number on talkie.com, TALKEE. And it was all black trans women who lived in California. And mind you, I dropped out of school in eighth grade. I was technically being homeschooled, but I wasn't doing the work. So all I did all day long was call the party line. And there was this black trans woman who I admired so much, had such like grit and would make the most wild, politically incorrect jokes. Charmaine was her name. And she inspired me so much because she would do character voices on there. So when I finally figured out that I could record on my digital camera, I was just honestly doing party line voice. I wasn't even thinking about, you know, black, white, anything. I was just talking the voice on the party line. And a lot of them were like in the ballroom scene and stuff. And so this was before Drag Race. I didn't hear What's the Tea or whatever on Drag Race. I learned it from the party line. And in my first video I ever posted, I was like, what's your tea like that? So... you know, like they taught me the lingo and stuff. So I have very fond memories from the trans party line days. Sorry to get off topic, but I just.
No, I was going to ask you about that too, because yeah, that seemed like to be the first revelation of the phrase T. And I guess it came specifically from like black LA drag queens / trans.
Or New York queens. I think all the ballroom scenes kind of, yeah, like that lingo, very Paris is burning. Yeah.
In that piece, you also said, it's not like I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. I'm just, you know, is that something that, is that still the case? You never, because you've transitioned since then, obviously. You came out in 2021 right. as Kara Cunningham. And I think you were experimenting with your, you also experimented in the other direction. You had a period where you went more mask, and I think this probably overlapped with your porn career. There was a period where you went more masculine as a way of like exploring a more masculine side than your natural kind of boyish flamboyant side. How do you feel about that now?
Like statements that I made. Well, I've
also or just generally about your gender fluidity.
I think that specific time, like in that article, because I was like 18 in that article, I was making videos that I hadn't even posted online, talking with my grandma daily about like how I do feel trans, and I still have those. And I think because it didn't seem like a possibility that I was transgressing against like what I wanted, I guess, because I didn't foresee a future where that could even happen, given where I live, my family, who I love, like so many things. And you can even see my relationship to my gender be a little more inconsistent and hypocritical to my current stances as the years went on. I said shit like, oh, well, I'm neither male or female, I'm both. You know, I was that was my way of coping and like just grappling with the lack of possibility, I think. And so, yeah, it was just a cope. I mean, and then the porn thing, I've always said I have a separation of church and state when it comes to my sexual persona versus my gender expression, right? So I feel much more comfortable in everyday life presenting female aesthetically. I just feel a lot less dysphoria. I just feel more comfortable. But in the bedroom, I have always had like a much more, I'm like a dom top, like, and my voice gets lower. So that's why I get jealous of autogynephiles who like can get turned on by having boobs or whatever. Cause yeah, I like guys to think I'm sexy, but I can't get turned on by my femininity. Whereas living as a gay guy, I could like look in the mirror and be like, damn, like I would fuck my own ass, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, now I don't have that relationship with myself, and it's weird because now I'm just like, oh, well, other people have to find me hot. I can't find myself hot, you know? So but the porn thing was also a way of, I had been so made fun of by like gay people, and they were constantly telling me I was what was wrong with the community for being like, back then it was, they would just call you a flamer or whatever. And so it was kind of my way of like being like, you laughed at me, so now you're going to jerk off to me, I think was my exact logic.
Right. Yeah. Cause you know, I remember when you went into porn, because it was, what, tell me the year that you went into porn, that you first started doing porn. It was like 2011, 12. And that is it for the free portion to listen to the spicy second half of this over 2 hour bombshell adventure with the one and only Kara Cunningham. Subscribe to the show at patreon.com/filthyarmenian. I know you were planning to do it anyway, so this is kind of a redundant message. If you do subscribe, you will get more than twice as many feature episodes. You'll get a dozen short mini eps a month called Smoke Breaks. These are like little 5 to 20 minute instant reactions to topics, movies, TV shows, and weird incidents of the day. It's kind of a spiritual news report I've been doing since December, and it's been very popular among the subscribers. So that's an extra, it's not even needed, but it's all the more reason why you should be supporting this show. And you know you should be supporting the show. And I do appreciate you listening and spreading the word. And I hope you enjoyed what you've heard so far. And I'll hope to see you on the other side of the paywall. Thank you.